I learned every lesson the hard way, for sure. It's not necessary to do that yourself. I don't like to lowball anyone in anything. You know, I like to come to the table and be really clear about what we're doing here. And if I'm offering a number, it's not because I want to. Yeah, you're exactly right. There is that tension. Yeah, thinking of it as with any deal, and I've since done a few other deals. It's just never done until we could see with a product like Square One that, you know, you could lift up a whole country by helping our next generation to be better with money. No regrets. Need that tattoo still. I would have loved to, if I could go back and have a word with myself, would have loved to.
Welcome to Two Commas, the podcast where we talk about seven-figure plus exits. This is all about exits and all about the journey and the lessons learned along the way. Today, I'm really excited to have on the show Jovan Pavlicevic. I've been taught how to say that correctly, and I hope that I got it right. Jovan has a bit of a storied career in and around entrepreneurship, and he's got a real journey to share with us in his process to getting to a sale experience. And so, Jovan, thanks for coming on the show today, brother.
Great to be here, mate. Thanks for the invite.
Nice. So I always like to kick off with a bit of a backstory, actually. So my research had dug up that you love motorcycles. That's perhaps less professional than it is personal. We're a firefighter, started a business in a foreign country. I'm probably stealing some of your thunder here, but give us like the potted, you know, couple of minute version of your backstory, if you could please, Jovan.
Far out, mate. Yeah, there's a good researcher there, obviously. Yeah, on the personal side, yeah, love my motorbikes, and we could probably sit here and do an hour
wax
on
lyrical.
That if you
yeah.
want.
Mm-hmm. Another podcast.
Yeah, never managed to go professional, but still waiting on that phone call from Team Yamaha.
I'll call some people, see if we can arrange something.
Thank you. Yeah, and I was a firefighter, actually. I think, I don't know the exact stat, but it's something like 90 or 95% of the New Zealand Fire Services volunteer. So I was a volley. This was going back a few years now as well, down in Littleton. I lived in Christchurch for a few years in Littleton, just through the tunnel there. And I think at the time it may still be that was one of the only ports in the world that was looked after by a volunteer brigade. So yeah, some super interesting, super exciting experiences with that. And loved the academic side as well as the kind of the physical nature of it. So that was kind of very early years, fresh out of school, those kind of years. And then made my way over to the UK and thought I would go for a few weeks or maybe a couple of months, and ended up 12 years later having got married, started a family, started and sold my first business over there. So it turned into quite a journey in the UK.
Yeah, amazing.
And yeah, now back here. Took a few years off after that and looked at a number of different opportunities, but conscious, I guess, as your audience will know as well, that kind of that journey of building something, it's a marathon. I took a few years off after selling Forest, my first business, and then launched into Square One and Emerge, and that's been keeping us pretty busy for the last sort of 3 years.
Yeah, love it. We'll come back mid to late in the conversation and talk about Emerge and Square One, because there's a great story to be shared there. But you mentioned along the way that building a startup is a marathon, and sometimes it feels like a marathon that you need to sprint in. So it could be a series of sprints that are in the distance of a marathon. There's many analogies that we could draw there, but let's come back to that later on. So I'm curious. So Forest was a financial advisory firm. Talk me through the origins, like how you got started, what opportunity you saw in the marketplace, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So Forest was an ICAEW member firm, so Chartered Accounting Practice, FCA regulated financial advisory. The bread and butter of it, really. There were a handful of different products or lines of business. The bread and butter of it was mostly around outsourced employment. So it's not a concept that's huge here in NZ, but it's a pretty well developed market in the UK, in the US, and Europe, and countries where you've got these, you know, much larger workforces, I guess. And yeah, I could see an opportunity where this was still being done by and large, by really sort of dusty, old fashioned accounting firms. And, you know, the sign up process would involve sending people stacks of paperwork, and then things would get lost in the post and need to be signed in triplicate. And then you needed to, as well as an individual to sign it, their agent needed to sign it. And it was sort of, it really was pretty bonkers to me that we were laborious, still doing it that way when I could see all of this. I could see this was kind of mid-2000s, I guess. I could see that so much was moving online. And so that was really the opportunity that I saw, was to take that business model and digitize it effectively, make it easy, remove all the friction. I think just as a person, I can't stand friction. If there's an easier, obviously easier way of doing something, I sort of go, well, why do you make me do this? Why, when you've asked me to write my name down on a piece of paper, do you then make me write it down on another piece of paper or write my full address out five times? Like, you know my address. You've already made me write it down. Don't make me do it again and again and again. So, it comes probably just from a personal frustration, wanting to remove friction, make things easy when it's obvious that it doesn't need to be that way, and it's only been made difficult because it hasn't been thought through. So I guess that was the genesis of that. You know, you asked about what the opportunity I could see was, and it was to digitize all of that stuff and make it really simple where it was just needlessly complicated before.
There's an interesting theory that goes along the lines of, I think it's called complexity theory, and if you subscribe to the fact that the universe is ever expanding, or the universes are ever expanding, then what that naturally means is that the world and the space in which we live is gaining complexity day by day. And with the rate and pace of change in the world that we live in today, it's, you know, that paradigm is no truer than the experience that we have of just being a human being. You know, there's more and more products, there's more and more advertising, there's more and more solutions, there's more and more content that's being pushed our way. And so you have to resist getting drawn into complexity. It's very easy to kind of get stuck into that thing. Tina, my wife, and I have a question that we ask ourselves if we kind of find something quite challenging, quite difficult to do. How do we make this easy? And it's not because we're trying to find a lazy way around doing something, but it's more because if you let it, you can have a deep degree of complexity turn up in things that doesn't need to be there. And so I love that the origin story of Forest was essentially a question of, how do we make this process and this experience easy and better for the stakeholders that we serve? So I'm always interested when people are starting something which is a new offering in the marketplace, and they're essentially, I'm guessing, attempting to disrupt. You mentioned the fuddy-duddy, you know, kind of fairly antiquated approach competition that you were dealing with. In that space, when you're a challenger, there's always kind of big inflection points, and those are the things that lead you, springboard you from kind of where you are to where you want to be. There's never just one. Sometimes there is just one, but there tends to be a sequence of those things. But those kind of inflection moments, those sliding door perhaps moments, the things where it was really, really supportive of you achieving the things that you wanted to achieve. So what are one or two of those things that pop out in your memory when you were going through the process of building Forest?
Gosh, yeah, we're going back a few years, but there are also the negative inflection points. Some of those, in a way.
Pick either one.
Are more memorable. But on the growth side, and kind of on the positive side, one of the things we did was come up with the idea for the first white label in that industry. That was really interesting, and then managing to win a couple of partner clients who took that service up.
Okay, so you built your own IP, white labeled it for others to be able to take into the market.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a pioneering move. I love it.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, and it was kind of pioneering, actually. Now you use the word at the time, so it took a bit of bravery on behalf of the those customer partners to take something like that on when it had never been done before. That was certainly one. I think there were a lot of those steps on the journey. And what I noticed was, I guess we started like right in the doldrums of the credit crunch. City of London, financial services, this was kind of like late 2011. So, 2008 onwards had just been getting, really, really tough. And so, we started in a room kind of half this size.
This is about the size of a big bedroom, by the way, if you can't see it at home on the camera.
With a desk and a sheet of paper.
Yep.
Learn to, it's kind of a cliche saying, but run on the smell of an oily rag, super lean. That served us pretty well. We grew with that mindset. And once the tide started to turn and economy, rising tide lifts all boats and all of that, but, the clients that we'd, had to work really hard for to win, their fortunes all of a sudden start to look a lot better. And so we've onboarded this good kind of stable of really happy, loyal customers, and we've been with them kind of, either since their inception or through their really challenging times, and we've done whatever we can to support them. And then they start to grow, so they're super loyal. So as well as growing the customer base, all of our customers were growing pretty quickly. So that's I don't know if that's like a single inflection point, but it's a big part of the story was just noticing that we launched in that really, really crunchy time, and then seeing things after probably a good 3 years. And by that stage, of course, as well, it's the kind of test, at the start, well, who are you? How long have you been in the market? Can we trust you with our business? New company. So after you've been around a few years and proven that you can get through sort of those challenging times, things just started to go from strength to strength. And then those first white labels were another big inflection point for sure. But as I say, probably the more memorable ones are some of the negative inflection points.
Let you dwell on whether or not you want to share one of those. What I've heard you say there is a combination. My distillation of it is discipline around financial control and expenditure at the outset, smell of an oily rag, perseverance, so not taking no for an answer, and then innovation. So they sound to me like they were kind of three pillars that you built Forest on. Is there one of those negative inflection points that you wanted to share? Because what do they say? We learn more from the things that don't go well than from those that go well. You either succeed or you learn is the positive way to frame it, but the not succeed is potentially failing. That's just a framing question. So talk us through one of those things.
Yeah. One of the more memorable ones, and it sort of came towards the end as we were gearing up for sale. We'd had a customer borrow a pretty substantial amount of money. Bear in mind that we weren't a lender. This was done on a business relationship level to a pretty reputable person who had been around in that industry for decades, had held governance roles, et cetera, et cetera. So, the word of that person was pretty well respected, and so we lent a not inconsiderable amount of money on a personal guarantee basis, and you can probably guess where this goes.
We're good.
So
Forest.
We didn't win. We learned on that one.
Ouch. So did they just disappear with the money?
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Fled the country, and then it unraveled that we were kind of just the last in quite a string of businesses who'd found themselves in that situation.
Wow, that's abhorrent. So kind of a Ponzi kind of thing, and they were just fleecing businesses along the way, and that's disgusting.
Yeah,
that would have been tough.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And the outward appearances of, driving luxury cars and owning horses and things like this. So, when the ask for the money is it's just a paltry amount, you know. So that was a big learning.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
As a consequence, I presume now that you would lend money only with security that would be involved, or something different.
We'd have to have a discussion about that off the air, I think.
Totally. That's fair.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that was on the way when you were getting close to the exit. So talk us through the journey just directly before you decided that now might be the right time. So what was going on in the business? What was going on in your life that led you to go, timing could be right for us to look at selling this thing? You were the sole founder, by the way, or do you have a co-founder?
Yeah, sole founder.
Yeah.
Brought in a really, really strong FD as a business partner sort of a year or two down the line.
Okay.
Which worked out really well. The question was what was going on around, or what triggered the sale almost? So I could foresee when we started, we were one of probably, you could count the providers on one hand. And after 5 years, it was getting on for 500-600 maybe in the market. It absolutely mushroomed because it was a very lucrative business model, relatively low barriers to entry, no sort of defensible IP around it, services business. So that encouraged a lot of people, and not all of them great operators or well-intentioned. So it encouraged a real rush into that space. And so we were kind of in that second tier, I guess, if you think of it as analogous to kind of law firms or banks or things like that. You've got the kind of the big four, and then, you know, another tier below that, and then kind of maybe everyone else. And so we were in that, pretty well established in that second tier. I could just foresee, you know, there were a lot of legislative changes coming through, a lot of, just political, social, economic changes happening. And I just could see that this business model was becoming increasingly commoditized. We'd done a lot to differentiate on brand, and we were really pretty successful with that. But I just could see that the newer operators, more and more people entering the market, they were increasingly smaller and smaller firms. So you'd get down to sort of 1-2 person bands. And, you know, the only vector they could compete on was price. And so then corners get cut on compliance. And it was becoming increasingly commoditized. And so I thought there'd be some kind of great consolidation or something was gonna happen because of that just the mushrooming that had occurred in that space in the 5 years that we'd been operating. Coupled with that, young family, both Kiwis and first daughter was ready to start school and second one on the way. So it had kind of been for the previous few years, kind of one more year, and the business is going, well, we'll give London one more year after, 12 years or so there. We'd been giving it one more year for a few years. Real combination of all of that stuff, ready to draw a line under that time in the UK and get back home to NZ.
Yep.
And we had an advisor come in around that time, and this was another inflection point probably, who was looking over everything, and I would describe myself as a pretty enthusiastic amateur at the time. I probably still am. Every day's a school day. So, he came in and sort of looking through everything and went, well, that's quite a good little business here. You know, you could sell this. And I went, oh, really? It had never occurred to me that that might be a thing. With that kind of idea planted in the head, and looking at what was happening in the industry and trying to find someone. You know, there were a few kind of bigger players or other players who were more bullish and potentially looking to consolidate. So, yeah, just started kind of feeling those conversations out. And basically, as soon as I opened those conversations, it all happened really quickly.
Mm. How did you do that? So you started feeling those conversations out. This kind of initiation thing is of interest to kind of a lot of people when they believe that there might be a logical acquisition partner. Mm. But how did you do that? Did you do it yourself, or did you have a broker that was involved, or an IB? Or talk us through that early conversation initiation piece.
It's a very boring, simple answer. I just got on the phone.
You rang people up? Did the old school hustle?
Just ring people up and say, hey, hi.
I'm your van.
Yeah. Would you like to chat?
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
That's simple. I mean, I love that. That's a from the outside, people would go, that's a little bit of a naive thing to do. But if it got you the result that you wanted to get, then it doesn't matter. You know, bringing naivety to the table.
I probably displayed my naivety through that process. You know, and you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about how much there is to learn in that process. And, yeah, I learned every lesson the hard way, for sure. And it's not necessary to do that yourself. Yeah, you can definitely learn from the mistakes of others and the wisdom of others. People, this has been done millions of times. There's no need to, as I did, as a first-timer, go through that and learn every lesson the hard way.
Mm. So you picked up the phone, you hustled some people that I presume were competitors. How did you establish who were the right businesses to call, and then talk us through that kind of early couple of 3 months or so where you're talking to people that could be potential acquirers?
Mm. So, yeah, it was through there was an introduction there or a suggestion of making contact. So I'd been talking to other, you know, peers in the industry, co-opetition, I guess, and one had recently been acquired. And so, yeah, just said, oh, who have you sold to? And ended up starting that conversation that way. At the same time, we had an offer from a customer who was staggeringly large, by far and away the biggest customer we'd ever interface with, PLC, global beast, of the size of the likes of an Adecco or something of that kind of nature, global footprint, and a real marquee customer for us to get on board. And we were in conversations with their executive team to, it wasn't Adecco, by the way, it was a company like that. And that sort of stature. And, yeah, so we were in conversations with them to basically replace all of their suppliers. And with this, I've mentioned we'd sort of kicked off that white label concept. And, for them to do kind of like an insourced move or a vertical integration and bring that capability in-house through purchasing us. And then, you know, connecting us to drink from the fire hose, and basically replace all of those, that full suite of suppliers. So we had the choice to kind of go on that journey, and I was looking at that like, that's a massive kind of doubling down, and staying at the, you know, I had that option, I guess those two options at the time are running in parallel. To kind of exit or double down, and then there was a third one at the time, which was somewhere in between the two.
Okay.
So
the middle option was a partial exit, but you would have had to have do a reasonable earn-out, but then manage that transition for that business so that they'd be able to realise the vision that they had for your company?
Yeah, the middle one, close. Yeah, they were, and they ended up pulling it off actually quite successfully, really good team. Consolidating a large group of companies into one with all sorts of different capabilities or specialisms, and then doing a roll-up in a kind of a what did they do in the end? Trade sale, like private equity sale.
Yeah, okay.
And they did that pretty well in the end.
Sorry, I interrupted you. There was a third option that you then had at the table, which was kind of in between the first, which was essentially a sale to a bigger competitor, the second, which was a vertical integration opportunity.
Yep.
So they go further down up the stack, whichever way you look at it. What did the third look like?
The third was that last one, sorry, that was where they were doing this kind of roll up of into a big
Got
group.
It. Okay, yep. Cool.
Which was sort of halfway between the two.
Yeah.
Where I would have held a small stake going forward and then been part of that group with that aim of a sort of private equity exit.
Yeah.
So they did pull that off sort of 6 or 7 years later.
Wow, okay.
Really cool to see.
These things take time.
So.
So you had the plucky Kiwi thing, you initiated a few conversations that led to some more serious conversations. I'm guessing that you then had the pre-courting kind of, what do you want to achieve? And they're asking you the same thing and what's your number? And you're all playing all coy about this kind of thing.
So typically
what tends to happen is people get into the DD process with one company. So is that kind of how things played out for you? And how did you pick which was the likely suitor for you?
We were in DD kind of with all three really at once. And we did end up with these three offers. And if I were a bit smarter at the time and a bit better negotiator, I might have managed to try and sort of play them off against each other in some way. But I didn't really dive into that too much.
You were doing this alone as well, weren't you? You didn't have a team of advisors that were around you to give you the suggestions.
Yeah, this is the other thing, right? I really was just navigating this all for the first time. Just flying solo. And so, there was a real lack of guidance through that process. We had some accountants, we had some lawyers, and reasonable, probably not top tier lawyers, but pretty, well, they charged enough.
They felt top tier.
So. They have very nice salmon sandwiches and things when you went to visit them. So
it's a great way to assess lawyers' competence is the quality of the triangle sandwiches.
That's it. Especially in London, right, there's a great sort of heritage in some of those. You've got to be in the right postcode to be considered. Is it a golden circle?
I think so. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, they were sort of advising on the deal, but they weren't it was more paperwork, box ticking kind of stuff rather than being an advisor.
Yeah, they weren't so much a deal advisor as they were like a technical contractual advisor.
Yep.
And the accountants would have been probably a, evaluation advisor around the, the cash flow and the gross margin and, that sort of thing and what dollar returns might have meant. The thing that would have been super helpful by the sounds is someone that had been through that journey before, that had understood what an M&A process looks like and how to enable the founder to structure a deal that works really well for them.
Mm.
So that's such a useful person to have on your side when you're going through that journey. The thing that I do like about what you did, though, instinctively you built deal tension through having three companies go through concurrently, because it's very hard to create that if it doesn't exist. And so tension leads people to, A, move a bit quicker, B, probably think they need to put their best foot forward
100%.
In terms of the deal structure as well. And so you had three that were working through. Did you end up with three offers for the company?
Yeah, two. The sort of straight exit and then the be part of this roll-up for private equity. And then the third one with this customer who was looking at that kind of vertical integration that was ongoing in the sort of final stages.
Yeah. Which one did you pick and why?
In the end, just the straight exit.
Yeah.
Why? It was a combination of things, wanting to get back to NZ and feeling I was kind of done with that industry, I guess, and the idea of staying on with a very minimal percentage holding in something that, may go somewhere one day but would still require some input and But from New Zealand to London, that seemed a bit kind of challenging. Mm. And so, ended up taking the straight exit. Coming back to NZ.
Yep, seems prudent. So what were the terms of the deal, as much as you can share about that?
Yeah, gosh, I'd have to dust off the old emails. Terms in respect of?
The way the valuation was established and whether there was any kind of warranties that you needed to provide, anything that was any gotchas at the back end of the deal, and whether it was all cash or whether it was paid out over a period of time. That's really the first and the last that I'm interested in. So how did they establish what they believe to be a fair value? Mm. And then how was the money going to end up coming across to you, and what tranches, et cetera?
Yeah, okay. So the valuation was, and as I find it always is now, having done a few capital raises and things since. A lot of spreadsheets and rigor can be applied to things, and then I think it's like with any purchasing decision. I believe from a pair of shoes to a business. People buy with their hearts first, don't they? And then then you rationalise it afterwards.
100%. And
make the spreadsheet that fits with that.
Fits your narrative.
So we went through that dance, and as you say, there was that little bit of competitive tension as well. I could have done a lot better job of that at the time. So we went through that process. The other guys had their sort of formula on how this should be done. They'd made a couple of acquisitions. Their kind of stated vision was to acquire a handful of these type of businesses and to roll out the Forest Way, our way across the group. And so they'd done three or four maybe smaller acquisitions, and this was the biggest one. Mm-hmm. They came with a pretty clear idea of how they thought it would be valued. We had our own thoughts on that. There was a robust sort of back and forth.
How big was the delta between what their idea was and what yours was? Let me talk about percentage points rather than dollar points. Were you kind of 5% apart, or were you 55% apart kind of thing?
Probably more like somewhere between 30 to 50%.
Okay, that's significant.
So a bit of a gap.
That's interesting, because often if you imagine buying an asset of any reasonable value, like a house, for example, and I'll just make a number up. Let's say you're buying a house for $1 million and they wanted $1.5 million, that 50% delta is, if you were to receive that offer as the person that wanted $1.5 million and you got $1 million, you'd probably walk away because you're never going to close that delta, right? So what made you believe that you might be able to get closer to it, and then what did you do to close that gap?
Mm. Good questions. What made me believe it? I'm just a radical optimist.
Great.
And as you picked up earlier, not necessarily taking the first no.
Mm-hmm.
We did have that bit of competitive tension, not to keep banging that away on that same point, but that helped as well. And I believed that was just a kind of a cheeky lowball to start things off, and I had a pretty good sense. Like I don't like to lowball anyone in anything. I like to come to the table and be really clear about what we're doing here, and if I'm offering a number, it's not because I want to start here and then see if we can work our way.
That wasn't their style,
by the sounds. Was very, very much not their style. And so they were really, pretty different sets of people fundamentally as well, and quite different approaches to work and to business and to negotiation, as we were finding out.
Mm.
They sort of came with this initial I would say, looking back, I'd call it a cheeky lowball.
Yeah, right.
As a test, maybe.
I wonder if I can offer that as well. You mentioned that they were going through a process of kind of rolling up a lot of these similar types of firms with a view of building a bigger entity, and they'd bought three or four smaller players, and you were the largest acquisition for them. So, you know, I'd read into that a couple of things. Firstly, they perhaps weren't prepared for the quantum of the difference between the smaller businesses they'd bought and yours, so that's possibly on their mind. Second thing is that... you know, I reckon either instinctively or consciously you might have gone, I'm of strategic importance to this firm because they kind of need to do this deal. And I'll leave you to ponder that while I back that up. One of the things that one of my guests has indicated is that you've got to remember when you're at the table with people here, especially when you're dealing with a medium to large firm, and if there's M&A people that are sitting on the other side of the people from that firm or as external advisors, they want to do the deal. Right, they're not there to have a nice conversation, eat the salmon cucumber sandwiches and drink some nice English breakfast tea. You know, they want to do the deal. And so I think with some odd exceptions whereby someone's looking to lowball and get a deal based upon a beleaguered business or a economically challenged environment or whatever it might be, which is not the case. You talked about a growing market and you had some unique IP and you had some good tailwinds in behind the business, growing business year on year. I guess, you know, those things are probably all playing around in your mind, but also the whole, how did you manage? This is a curious question for me. When you're going through the process of negotiating and thinking about selling your business, my experience is that it's quite tricky because you've got to keep one foot firmly grounded inside the business, and that's the, this deal may not happen and we need to continue growing. Even if it does happen, I need to make sure that the hand is firmly on the tiller. And the other foot is kind of in that place of freedom, maybe financial freedom, certainly time freedom, and freedom from the thing that has been a labor of love. You know, building a business, starting a business, especially as a sole founder, is an absolute labor of love. And so how did you manage that tension between those two things?
Probably not very well. With sleepless nights and racing thoughts, I guess. You're exactly right. There is that tension. How to manage it? I think thinking of it as with any deal, and I've since done a few other deals, and it's just never done until it's done, is it? And you have to treat these things as just potential large distractions, and afford them the attention that they need or deserve at the time. But also, just remaining really, really cognizant of the fact that it is just a distraction until it's actually done, and money has changed hands.
Yes.
And that's the point at which it's actually done.
So
that would be my advice, I guess, would be wary that these things are potentially massive distractions that can just derail what you're doing.
Yeah. I've actually heard of a strategy that's been employed by a competitor in an industry to go about the process of engaging other businesses in that space, getting them into a conversation that looks like an acquisition conversation.
100%.
With a view of being, it's going to distract them and they'll take their eye off the ball, so to speak, and then the competitor can come in and cut their lunch across different segments.
Yep.
And maybe wait for a year and then buy the assets of the business at maybe cents on the dollar, maybe 50% less because the growth has stalled or perhaps even the company's contracted. And so, you know, there's some... I don't go into a conversation or a deal with the expectation that someone's going to be nefarious, but having a view to what are they doing and why are they doing things in this way is a really helpful thing when you're going through that process.
100%, that's a risk, right? And if they are a competitor and a slightly bigger one and maybe you're nipping at their heels and you're then disclosing all of your financials, you know,
customers, contribution,
Your
product, you know, your offering that you're taking to the markets. It's quite a can be quite a fraught and a risky process.
Yep. 100%. That happens. Yeah.
So you back end of the deal negotiating, you managed to close that gap. Approximately, just off the top of your head, did you give 50-50 or did you get them to there was that gap of 30-40%. Did you give half each, or did you get them closer to you than they did to?
We came pretty much to the middle of that gap.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah. Enough to do the deal. What did I hear someone say once? That a
as
good
long
deal.
As everyone's unhappy. Or?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. a good deal is one that neither party is elated, but both are prepared to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting perspective on the world. So you did the deal. Terms, was all cash? Did you get all the cash immediately, or was it over a couple of tranches?
Yeah, a little bit of an earn out for – it was pretty quick, really. Like several months.
Yep. Okay. Just,
A few months.
Okay. Couple of 4 months kind of thing.
Most of it on the nose, and then a bit of trail over sort of 3-4 months, and
yes,
and that was that. Yes. And the one bit I wasn't prepared for. I don't know if it's kind of on your radar of things to talk about, but the kind of what next as well.
Please.
That's one of the biggest things. I don't hear anyone talking about it, and there was no thought applied to it, and we had. Yeah, as I say, various kind of advisors and kind of people around the deal and around the business. And I sort of thought I was in my, I guess, early 30s and, oh, great, you know, now I can retire and we'll move back to NZ and, you know, get a nice place in the country and get out of
buy
the city.
A farm and, yeah.
It really was pretty cliche stuff. Might sell some eggs,
have some chickens and a couple of goats.
So I made it as far as looking after the neighbours' chickens once when they went away, and I said, nah, it's not for me.
Too high maintenance.
Oh, my gosh. Mm.
And they're noisy.
Nightmare. So, you know, I had that in my mind, and that's great. It's an idea. But I definitely was not prepared for that kind of the disassociation of yourself from the business, and you know, as you said, as the sole founder, it's the labor of love, and I did at least, and I think it's pretty common that you sort of wrap your self-worth into the business, or if you're the figurehead of this team and you're responsible for your people and all of that
identity,
and sort of your identity, right? And so you've spent 5 years. I had spent 5 years doing that and enjoying that, and then one day that just turns off, and your bank balance looks a bit different. But I was definitely not prepared for what that meant.
Mm.
And then I would say you can feel a bit adrift. A couple of months can go by, and that's great. But, you know, how long do you want to be on holiday would be my question if we're talking to people who are thinking about this. Like, at the same time, you almost need a third foot. Like you say, you've got one foot in the camp of potentially selling, and the other foot has got to be firmly in the business and your hand firmly on the tiller and navigating that. And then you also need to be thinking about, okay, what are you actually going to do after this?
Yeah.
Because there is only so long that you would want to, or you can sit on the beach with a pina colada, and you know, you phone a friend up to go out on the boat, and they said, "But
I'm working. It's
2
Tuesday.
O'clock on a Tuesday afternoon, mate. What do you? Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Yes.
So definitely, you'd need to. I would have loved it if someone had. Offered some kind of coaching around those aspects as well, not just, what are the contractual terms, how many pounds are involved in this deal, you know, those kind of structural, technical, very hard-edged, easy to quantify elements.
Yeah.
There's all this other side as well for you as a person afterwards.
Yeah. The whole purpose and meaning thing. And so do you recall, and it may be something that is really fresh to mind for you, but I'll ask the question nonetheless. You've gone through the exit, and there's a term that's attached to this, by the way. It's called founder's remorse.
Mm.
And so it's typically not always just one, but when you're the sole founder, as I've been in my first business, you are the chief cook bottle washer. Your name probably isn't above the door, but metaphorically it is above the door. And, you know, very deep in the whole, you know, identity, purpose thing, and you build the business in your own image typically as well. And so when you that money was sitting inside the bank account, financially free from that moment forth. So how did you kind of rationalise that thing, like my business is gone and yet I'm financially free? So there was tension, obviously, that existed there. You mentioned that it would have been great if you could have spoken to someone like a coach or someone in that kind of capacity. Mm-hmm. But maybe you didn't have time to dwell on what it all meant for you from here. But I've spoken to others and I've had this own, my own personal experience around this, which was, so what is it all about then?
Yeah.
Which is a very privileged European male perspective to have on things, and I'm really aware of that, but I'll call it out nonetheless because this is a show about people that are considering taking their business to an exit process at some stage, building and exiting a business. And, you know, for most of us, once we get to that stage, it's not a, oh, thank God that thing's happened, you know, shout from the rooftops. That happens at the start, right? You have a couple of weeks, maybe a month of celebrating and good times and kind of, you know, the world is your oyster and possibility, but then the world is your oyster and the world is full of possibility and uncertainty. And then you kind of go, so what does it all mean now? And so I had to grapple personally with the whole purpose and personal identity thing because I'd attached mine to my first business and that had now gone. It was under the stewardship of some other people.
Right.
They were doing great things with it. I maintained some equity, but I wasn't operational and I only sat on the board for a period of time. A couple of years was the plan and we stuck to that. And so I had this kind of feeling of being adrift and kicking around. And you know, the thing that I did was I was in such an ingrained habit of being busy, 50, 60, 70 hours a week, sometimes 100, that my calendar was chock full. Like I handed over the keys at the end of September on October the 1st, 2015, I think it was, 2014. I essentially didn't have a job. And I travelled for a short period of time and then I came back and then my calendar was full. I was still having 8 to 10 meetings a week. I do not know today what those meetings were about.
Right.
I think they were people wanting money. I was fundraising because I'm an active investor, as you know. And so I think that's what they're about. But I was helping people with businesses and there were some people that wanted to, you know, maybe go into business with me and do the next thing. And so I distinctly remember getting to Christmas and my wife at the time, I said to her that I'm really looking forward to a holiday. And she goes, a holiday? Have you been working the last few months? Because I thought that you were taking time out. And I'd just been so habitually busy that that's what I did with my time. I just took all the meetings.
Yeah,
and I'd get the end
of
the week and I'd be tired and I'd want to put my feet up and I'd be emailing all day. I don't know what I was doing. But it was just such a habit set for me.
Yeah.
And I hadn't pondered and paused to think, okay, so what does it all mean? It
Why
took me a couple of years.
Now?
Yeah, exactly. And what do I do now and what do I make that mean? So does that resonate with you, any of that journey? And how did you kind of navigate your way through that, if so?
Yeah, it does, and it's just nice to sit and chat with someone who's been through similar things, because you don't. This isn't a conversation I've had many times at all, actually. And I guess for me, an additional layer to that was moving from after kind of 12-ish years in the UK, mostly in London, back home to NZ. But you know, by that point, kind of. You know, half of my life nearly I'd been in the UK. So arguably, you know, where is home? And then coming back to NZ and I thought, okay, I've achieved this exit. I've done something. I went off to London and I was pretty cool over there. And, you know, maybe they'll make me prime minister when I get back to the airport. They'll sort of carry me out on their shoulders and plonk me in the beehive.
They'll have the military procession.
They'll open up,
they'll give you a big key.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
No, none of those things.
That just, people sort of like, oh, who are you? Sorry.
You had no network, right?
Yeah, had no network here. I'd spent that kind of 12 years when you're, you know, pretty productive and pretty active and building your network and your reputation in your niche. I'd done that in London, which was great, but that means not a lot when you move back to NZ.
Yeah.
So that was another additional layer, I guess, as well as kind of being cut free from that aspect of your personality, to then be back back home again in a new country again. Yeah. So it was really interesting. I just threw myself into parenting full time for a couple of years and really enjoyed that.
Eventually,
you know, you start to have that kind of a work shaped hole in your life as well.
I want to talk about that work-shaped hole because I'm keen to discuss and explore the business that is on your shirt, Emerge. Before doing that, just I think one last question about the deal as it was done. There's two questions actually. One of the things that my research had dug up is that you, as a part of that journey with building Forest in the UK, one of the key things that you took away from it as an experience was the fact that you're all about the people. And leadership style is very much aligned to, you didn't use the word servant leadership, level 5 leadership, but that's kind of the sense that I've gotten from you and spending some time with you over the last year or so as well. How did you kind of reconcile that piece with, I'm selling this business now and it's a services company with a couple of products that we'd built as well. How did you kind of reconcile that you're all about the people you'd hired, you'd grown all of these people, you'd nurtured these people as well, no doubt, along the way? Maybe it was part of what we've just talked about here, that kind of, you know, founders remorse, separation anxiety, the fact that you weren't going to be around with those folk anymore and you weren't going to be CEO or MD of that thing anymore. So that kind of maybe added to the thing for you or something different. But I'm just curious how you reconciled that piece, if you had to.
Yeah, that was... never like to refer to myself as a leader. Still can't sort of bring myself to do it.
No, great.
I'd say that kind of servant leadership model is definitely where I sit. And I just love seeing people, like being able to sort of help develop people. That came from, you know, an amazing experience that I had with my first mentor. That's where I picked that style up from, effectively.
Yeah.
And just being, you know, in that position of being able to create opportunities for people and, you know, push them a little bit into, you know, into growth, help them uncover areas that they... or help them, you know, to do things that they didn't think they could previously do. I love doing that as a dad as well. I think that's, you know, parenting is kind of all about almost, helping our kids to uncover their own potential. I love that part of being in a team and building a team. And to reconcile that, with the exit, that was a challenge. You've observed a good point there. You know, how do you reconcile that? And how I reconcile it was everyone in that business went on to do really awesome things, greater things. And Forest was a real springboard. So the sort of recruitment model that I ended up building was essentially everyone just comes in at the bottom and then when a new person enters the business, everyone kind of gets bumped up a little bit. And you just keep on bringing people in at that junior level. And then after a couple of years, you've got someone who is doing the interviewing and saying, well, you know, 2 years ago I was in your seat and now I'm running a team of 10 people.
Yeah.
It became a real springboard because we were growing relatively quickly. Everyone could progress. There were no kind of limits on, you know, however much you wanted to learn, whatever you wanted to turn your hand to, there was an opportunity there for you. So go for it, prove yourself. Everyone in the team looks back on that pretty fondly as a time of great personal and professional growth for them that provided a platform where otherwise potentially they might not have had that chance. I know that's what it was like for me, starting at the bottom, and I remember people going, well, but your CV doesn't say you've got any experience. And it's like, well, why are you applying for this job?
Mm-hmm.
And me at that point going, but how are you supposed to get experience, please, if you can't? So that sort of paradox.
Yes.
yeah, we addressed that by getting people in who had great heart and passion, wanted to learn, a lot of energy, good people, effectively, first and foremost, and then train the rest. And so, yeah, everyone enjoyed a really, really good trajectory.
Mm.
And so they were able to go on from that with something pretty substantive, you know, that they could point to in terms of their experience and progress.
Yeah, yeah. I love that, that whole kind of, what is it, hire for attitude, not aptitude, is the synopsis of that. And there's so much joy to be taken from enabling and facilitating others' growth, you know, kind of being part of that journey. I actually think at our core, it's what we're hardwired for as a species, is to facilitate and grow other people. You know, there's no more miserable person than that's focused only on themselves, often in the wealth context. I know some quite wealthy people, and not all of those folk are terribly happy, especially if they haven't cottoned onto the whole service thing. You know, if it's all about just making money and making more money, making bank, then they tend to be quite insular and often quite miserable as well. So I think there's a lot of joy to be taken from leadership, and especially when it's around the growth of others. So
yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
That Scrooge archetype.
There you go. Yeah. 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 I think we just made one up. Let's just run with that. It's cool. So one last question about the forest deal, and then I want to talk about what you're up to these days. So no regrets, but looking back on the deal and the process, probably particularly of the deal, knowing what you know now, having been involved in more deals and having another kind of 10, 12 years of experience under your belt, what, if anything, would you have done differently?
No regrets. I need that tattoo still.
Yes.
yeah, oh gosh. I would have loved to, if I could go back and have a word with myself, would have loved to have someone kind of on my team, a coach, someone who's done it before, orders of magnitude, amounts of value that person can add, I think. Someone who's done it before.
Yeah.
Absolutely massive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really insightful thing to call out. Let's move on and talk about life now. So we met under the guise of the shirt that you're wearing. I love the bright blue logo and the kind of the stair escalator kind of concept that's going on there. It's an E. There's a lot
trying to evoke a bit of growth trajectory
upwards
with
to
that.
The right. Yep, I love it. Yeah. So I'm obviously familiar with Emerge, but the watchers and listeners aren't. Can you kind of tell us what you're up to and what you led you to that as well?
Yeah. Have we got another couple of hours or?
Possibly not. Okay. We might do, but I'm not sure everyone would be listening in a couple of hours. So.
So Emerge, we're building a bank alternative. We're not a bank yet. We certainly aspire to be. We're aspiring to build New Zealand's first challenger bank. As we were talking about before, right, it's a very topical thing at the moment. The winds of change are steadily blowing in that direction. And so we've spent the last sort of just about 4 years now since Jamie and I, as two co-founders, were at the kitchen table and you know, we'd been looking for, we've been great mates for the better part of two decades. We met over in London. Jamie's from the UK originally. He's been living here now for 12 plus years. And so we'd been looking for something to do together for a long time, and sort of life and career paths had done this over the years. We started to look at where the opportunities might be, thinking around, so Jamie's got three kids, I've got two. The first product is called Square One. So we started, that's been in market nearly 3 years now. And the idea started with, you know, could we make a wearable that kids could wear to the beach? How are you going to do money? How are you going to manage pocket money? How are you going to help your kids understand a bit about how money works, get them a bank account, things like that. When we're the first generation of digital native parents, who our kids have only ever seen us tap a card, and the only financial lesson they've ever had, because it's not taught in schools, parents don't have the tools or anything to talk about it. in our wonderful Kiwi culture, it's still a bit of a taboo, and you know, there's a whole, yeah, there's many, many conversations that could be had about why. And so, yeah, realizing that our kids have only ever seen mum or dad just tap a card to get what you want 24/7. That's literally the only financial lesson they've had. And we expect our kids to somehow magically, you know, turn 17, 18, leave home, get your first job, and then you'll somehow learn about money.
Yeah.
And probably you'll just make every mistake, learn every lesson the hard way, because that's how it happened for me and that's how it happened for my parents. No one talked to me about money, so I'm not going to talk to you about money. And yeah, it's just such a car crash, generational cycles over and over again of people having to learn the same lesson. And yeah, coming back to, I guess, my personality, like looking at that and going, why is this so broken and full of friction when it just doesn't need to be? And why is it the same for my daughters as it was for me? Mm. Like, there's 40 years here. Has there not been any progress in that time? No, there hasn't. So what are we going to do about it? And so, yeah, that was kind of the genesis with Square One. That sort of, there's a cheeky clue in the name that was just our first product. That was the first cab off the rank. The vision was always, it was never, could you make the world's best pocket money app? The vision was, could you build a bank? And we could see that because of, there's all these different verticals, right, of products or different customers that you might serve. And we could see that kind of next generation, our kids, like really, really difficult to get them even a basic bank account when it shouldn't be. Really almost impossible to even get them a card to go with that bank account or to get them internet banking access so they could see their balance. All these things that should be really fundamental if you're going to teach someone how to use money and have access to their own money, how to earn some, spend some, save some. We could see that if that was such a big problem for us, that it would be a big problem for a big number of people. And kind of at the same time as solving a whole lot of problems and doing something that, you know, my previous business has been a financial services business, had great, you know, commercial upside, but arguably, you know, the purpose or the social good element wasn't there. We could see with a product like Square One that, you know, you could lift up a whole country by helping our next generation to be better with money.
Mm.
Not that money's the most important thing, it's just another skill in life, like kicking a ball at a goal or playing the guitar or whatever.
Yeah, money's a necessity in this world as well.
It really is. You can't escape it. Even if you do want to say it's the root of all evil, you still need to buy your lunch
exactly. At
the end of the day. Mm. So it's pretty difficult to function without it.
Mm.
So it's an imperative life skill that we have to have, and you know, we don't do very well in NZ with it. So yeah, we could see a massive social upside as well, as a chance to kind of chance to build something pretty big and enduring, a really massive gnarly challenge in a really difficult space. And so Emerge is the kind of incarnation of that original vision of, could you build a bank? And again, we're not a bank. That's the path that we're on. Emerge is all about SME solving the problems that businesses have with all of their day-to-day banking. Like, we are really stuck on 1980s tech here in NZ. And so we're here to give that a massive shot in the arm, because we want to see Kiwi business succeed. And we want to solve those problems in the same way as we have done with Square One for our youth customers. So we're at 200,000 customers now in Square One, all in New Zealand still. And with Emerge, we want to solve those same pain points that businesses have and sort of own that vertical next. And we'll fill in the gap in the middle with personal accounts sometime in the next few quarters. We'll have those out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, steadily on that march towards full service registered bank one day.
Amazing. I love that story for so many reasons. As we were talking about over lunch beforehand, you know, the big four banks have been dominating the New Zealand sector to their advantage and not to the advantage of the consumer. So I love that someone who cares about the outcomes and the experiences that people have is wading into the space, and someone who's deeply connected with the reasons why that's important as opposed to just another money-making venture. I like your customer pipeline philosophy as well. You didn't say that, but it was quite clear to me that you get the young folk and then keep them as customers. They can flip at some stage into being business owners and or being the personal banking customers as well when that kind of evolution happens. And, you know, digital first is also a great space to play in. So you're taking SMB customers at the moment. So people would go to Emerge and then go through, I believe, a 5-minute sign-up process attached to your phone number. Is that correct?
Pretty good. Yeah, yep. Great. Yeah. Okay. Your researcher is still on point.
Yep, on point.
So yeah, you just download the app in your app store.
Yes.
And you're away. And, okay. You know, there's a little bit of extra if you've got underlying trust structures and things like that. But for a relatively straightforward limited company entity, you can be download the app, you can be onboarded, have your business accounts open, up and running within, I'd say take the 5-minute challenge. We won't make you write your name and address 5 times on 6 different bits of paper.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Yeah. 5 minutes, you're in, you've got your accounts opened, and then just a few more taps and you can issue cards to your whole team.
Yes.
Which solves a whole raft of pain points for businesses, you know, otherwise doing that manually or having the one card that gets shared around 20 people in the office, someone... Who's got the card today? Oh, Josh is in Christchurch, so no one has the card. And then you come back with a stack of receipts and someone has to manually deal with that. So, yeah, all that stuff goes out the window. We're still just getting started. So just raised our Series A, announced that a couple of days ago.
Just a couple of days, wasn't it? You hit the press. Yeah. What were those numbers, by the way, Jovan?
We raised $12 million.
Amazing. $7. Incredible. Well done.
Thank you.
She's a tough environment to raise in, getting that kind of quantum in this environment is no mean feat. I suspect that's been a few months in the making to get to the stage.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a push for a few months. And coming back to your earlier analogy of having a foot in two camps and us talking about what's a distraction and far out, raising is certainly a distraction from building the business and growing the team and being present in the business. It's a pretty big process unto itself. This is our fourth capital raise. Another whole discipline, learning how to raise capital as well as growing the business. And, yeah, when you're raising your seed round, for us, we were still pre-team, pre-customer, really pre-product, and so it was quite nice to kind of travel around and meet some of the local angel groups around New Zealand and go and meet people and pitch to them and tell the story and have the vision. It's a pretty different prospect where we are now, needing to get out and raise and put the time and resource into raising at the same time as, supporting the customer base that we've built now and the levels of regulatory compliance that we're subject to, et cetera, et cetera. It was a pretty exciting about 3, nearly 4 months end to end.
Okay. Not as bad as it has been for a lot of others. So, yeah, it's a great outcome. Outside of Emerge, what other, there might be one, there might be two, there might be none, businesses in New Zealand are you quite excited about at the moment?
That's a tough one, yeah. Because all of our Emerge customers are businesses.
Right, they're all exciting.
All very exciting. There's a handful out there. One of the things I enjoy the most about this role and building a startup is actually the amount of other startups that we get to meet and the amount of other founders. And you get a chance to sit down with someone like this and go really deep on their specific area of expertise. And there's some phenomenal subject matter specialists out there. Thinking of companies, there's a couple like OpenStar who are solving nuclear, which is the hard one, fusion or fission, the one that hasn't been done yet.
Fission, I think it is. Yes, fission. That's we'll the undone one.
We'll have to Google that.
Yeah, yeah, please
fact check. Yeah, down in Wellington, and yeah, pretty, just super interesting. Metrovate as well in the sort of plant science space. Yeah, there's a few that we're fortunate enough to meet lots on a really regular basis, and all of them are doing super exciting stuff that's groundbreaking, and kind of, yeah, NZ Inc., like challenging the world.
Love it. Yeah. Love that space. Such an exciting opportunity to rub shoulders and kind of share the journey that you're going on. Everyone's got their unique journey, but just kind of seeing people go through those trials, tribulations and successes along the way to business growth. So one last question for you, Jovan. So in that alternative universe where you didn't go into founding a business that was in the financial advisory kind of space, and you didn't come back to New Zealand and start a neobank, and all the other things that you've been involved in along the way, that alternative career that you didn't have, the thing that you think that may have brought you a lot of joy, what could that thing have been?
Yes, probably. We've covered two of them, the sort of the firefighting and motorbikes. Still waiting on that call from Yamaha.
Yeah, cool.
And music.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep, as in like guitar.
Making
or
music, yeah, drums, guitar.
Drums, guitar, amazing. Yep. Yeah, cool. Being a rock star, basically.
That's
one of the classic, you know, probably since the 1960s, kind of alternate careers of choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jovan, both lunch and this have been a really enjoyable and insightful conversation. I'm really grateful for you coming on the show. Looking forward to following your journey with Emerge. It's going to be super cool to see that take on the big four and win. And so I really appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you, mate. Likewise.
Thanks, brother.